Now, I wonder what you expected to be doing this evening. I'm sure you all expected to be here, didn't you? Even if England had made it to the final, you'd have been here. But I suppose it's just possible that some of you might have been hoping that the sermon was shorter than usual, and maybe even thinking that you'd skip the coffee afterwards. Certainly, a few weeks ago, millions of people in our land seemed to seriously believe they had a good chance of watching England triumph in the cup final tonight. Indeed, I've heard that some churches even cancelled their evening services in anticipation. Now, I'll let you decide whether you consider that to be an act of great faith or of great unbelief. But it was not to be. A lame performance against average opposition, the star striker sent off, and then the traditional penalty shootout collapse means that England fans taste disappointment and defeat once again. And still now, the inquests rumble on, don't they? Poor tactics, bad selection, excessive expectations, weak individual performances. After all, when you expect to win and then lose embarrassingly or badly, well, you want to know why, don't you? You want to know how to win next time. Now, what about when God's people taste defeat? What about them? In Christian faith, we use the imagery of victory in battle, don't we, all the time? Our songs often sing of it. We know that there's to be an ultimate triumph. On this rock I will build my church, and the gates of hell will not prevail against it, Christ said. And yet, in the meantime, there certainly are occasions when God's team get thrashed. And that's our theme for tonight. What about when we get beat? Where is the Lord when we need him? Now, of course, from the very beginning, we must acknowledge that what counts as defeat for the New Testament church is really very different to what counts as defeat in Old Testament Israel, let alone defeat in the world around us. When, for example, the church in China was decimated by Mao's persecution and all the missionaries sent home and so on, well, I'm sure that looked like a grievous defeat and felt like it at the time. But we now know, with the wisdom of hindsight, it's actually proven to be a great victory, hasn't it? We find similar examples in the book of Acts, where the church was persecuted and scattered, and it looked like the whole thing has crushed, a huge setback, yet the Lord used it to spread the gospel. So, in the New Testament church, we can't evaluate our victories and defeats in the terms of how things seem to us now, or how they might look to the eyes of the watching world. And the greatest victory of all in the Christian faith was, of course, the cross, wasn't it? And that looked like an abject failure at the time to all who looked on. But having said all of that, we surely have to acknowledge that it is possible for God's people to lose the battle. And I mean really lose, in a real sense. Surely as we look to the history of God's church in our own land, in this last century, in many key regards, we really have been the losers, haven't we? Not in every respect, of course. In some respects, things have gone on well. Or in every place, by any means. But in the big picture, it certainly looks like we've lost ground. In our culture. In the public debate. In the moral standing of our nation. In simple calculations like the numbers of people coming to faith and then going on to maturity. In the numbers of churches closing and retreating and declining. We know that's not the big picture globally, of course. But it's often the story locally, and it's certainly the story nationally. So how do we respond when it looks like we're getting beaten? Now, ancient Israel got plenty of practice at this at just different times and points in their history, didn't they? The account here begins with them getting a sound beating, and it's the old enemy, isn't it? Now, the Israelites went out to fight against the Philistines. The Israelites camped at Ebenezer and the Philistines at Aphek. The Philistines deployed their forces to meet Israel, and as the battle spread, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 of them on the battlefield. It's not a total wipeout, but it's a pretty solid kicking. And so when the boys limp back to Ebenezer, the elders of Israel hold an inquest to find out what went wrong. When the soldiers returned to camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines?" Now, at this point, we have to recognize that that there are two things, at least, that the elders of Israel got right at this point. Firstly, they were right to hold the inquest. There was something wrong somewhere, wasn't there? This shouldn't have happened. Israel had good reason to expect to win their battles. After all, they were God's people. He had a covenant with them. And he had promised, in the right circumstances, to fight with them and for them and give them victory against their enemies. And the Philistines, while pretty tough opposition, they weren't unbeatable. They were relatively few in number themselves. They were no Assyrian horde. And under Samson, only a few years before, Israel had been able to give the Philistines as good as they got from them. And it looks like that Israel had gone out for this fight. They initiated it. They went out to fight the Philistines, didn't they? And you got the impression that they did so expecting to win this time. This was no England versus Brazil. This was an England versus Portugal situation, wasn't it? So the elders of Israel were quite right to hold an inquest into the defeat and to look for answers. Now, could it be that one reason why the church in our day can find itself so far on the back foot is because we've not been sufficiently quick to do this? Sometimes it takes us years to even notice we're losing the battle at all. A colleague of mine was describing how a small evangelical denomination with which he had personal connections. And he says that for years this denomination had not managed to develop new leaders, train up new pastors. They knew it was important, but there was always something more important to do right now. And then all of a sudden they realized that they have dwindling elderly congregations and dwindling elderly pastors too. And humanly speaking, in terms of the time it takes to recruit someone and train them up and so on, well, it's too late to do anything about it. If anything was going to be done, as it were, they needed to recognize that a certain battle was being lost and address it some 20 years before. No, God's people do suffer setbacks, and they will become defeats, even full-blown routs, if one doesn't recognize what's going on. But setbacks should not cause us to panic. They should cause us to ask the right questions, examine ourselves, look for the reasons and for the answers perhaps, and to do so sooner rather than later. Sometimes we do that, and as we look at a situation, we conclude that what we thought was a defeat is no defeat at all. It may look like swathes of people have left our church. But then when we examine the situation and find that actually they've all gone on to serve the Lord in this situation or that situation in some really effective way, and we've been able to equip them and help them to do that, well, that's no defeat, is it? That's a victory in the Lord's plans. We may also look at a situation and say, actually, well, this is more like England versus Brazil than England versus Portugal. The situation where we do our best, but we know that apparent defeat is no disgrace. I'll give you an example. Many of the changes in our culture, which are sweeping around us now, are the results of decades of history and philosophy impacting the way people think and live today. And we don't beat ourselves up here at Surrey Chapel because the ground is harder evangelistically now than it might have been 50 years ago. No. We just recognize that it's a different sort of game now. And we work with the situation wherein the Lord has put us. But if it seems, it's the height of complacency not to ask the questions when it seems like we're losing, let alone to fail to notice it at all. And if in a church, say, numbers are declining and they're not going on to serve elsewhere, if people aren't coming to faith or even hearing the gospel, if young people are drifting away, if prayer or giving in the church is shrinking, or arguments between believers are dividing and weakening the fellowship, well, it's our responsibility to think why, isn't it? And for the leaders to realize them, to ask the right questions. So the elders of Israel were right to hold an inquest into this first defeat. And secondly, they were right to recognize that fundamentally it came down to God's role in the affair. They asked the question, why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? And that was the right question, wasn't it? Why did the Lord bring defeat upon us? And again, I think perhaps in this regard, they might be more spiritual than we can be sometimes. Not only might it take us 10 years to realize that we're losing a battle, and then another 10 years to get round to asking why, the first thought on our minds then might be, so what have we done wrong? What was wrong with our battle plan? Have those Philistines got better weapons than us? Have they got inside information, a spy that's telling them what we're going to do? That's what we might have assumed. That's a temptation, isn't it? To immediately address the human angle, assume it all comes down to what we or they are up to. Oh, our meetings are all wrong in their style, perhaps. Oh, our advertising is no good. Oh, we aren't trying. Or prayer. Oh, the pastor's goofy teeth are putting people off. Oh, the sound system isn't quite working correctly. That. How's that? Any joy? Good. Okay. And of course, all those things are valid considerations at the right point in the discussion. We have to ask, what are we doing? Are we doing things right? Are we not doing things we should? Are we behind the game in some way or other? But the elders of Israel were quite right to recognize that fundamentally, it was God's role in the battle and not their role or the Philistines that had led to their defeat. The Lord had brought defeat upon him. He's sovereign over all things. Ultimately, that can be the only reason why God's people are ever defeated, because the Lord has brought it upon us. And the elders of Israel were quite correct, not only in identifying that they had been defeated by God, but also in realizing that if they're going to win battles in the future, they needed to have him fighting for them, not against them. The church in our land today will only prevail if the Lord himself fights for us. Of course, we must consider the things that we do, but the issue that will determine it, one way or the other, is the part the Lord chooses to play. So when we're defeated, or think we're defeated, we don't start with an inquest into what we did and plans about what we will do next time. We start with the Lord himself, don't we? So the elders got some things right, but they also got some things spectacularly wrong, didn't they? They recognized that it was the Lord. They asked, why did the Lord bring defeat upon us today before the Philistines? Good. Let us bring the ark of the Lord's covenant from Shiloh, so that it may go with us and save us from the hand of our enemies. Bad. Now you can understand, though, why they did this. The ark, it's not Noah's ark, this is the special box in or over which God made himself especially present in the tabernacle. It contained the Ten Commandments on their tablets of stone and various other paraphernalia from their journey through the desert. And the top of the ark was the mercy seat, where the blood was sprinkled to make atonement for the whole nation. The ark itself was in no ways a bad thing. And they were quite right in their context to associate the ark with the presence of God with his people. There was no more potent and profound sign of their special relationship with God than this box. Nor were they completely off the wall to think that taking the Ark of God with them might give them victory in battle. That wasn't a crazy thought. After all, for example, the Battle of Jericho. Did God not tell the Israelites to march the Ark around the city? Now, they should perhaps have realized that they were getting into dodgy ground here, because God may have said do that at Jericho, but he hadn't told them to do it this time, had he? But there was a precedent. And hey, if they bring the priests along to keep an eye on things, what could possibly go wrong? It certainly did wonders for the soldiers' morale, didn't it? When the Ark of the Lord's Covenant came into the camp, all Israel raised such a great shout that the ground shook, they said. Now, unfortunately, it didn't do the Philistines' morale any harm either, did it? They were afraid at first. A God is in the camp. But that fear inspired them to fight all the more hard. Verse 9. Be strong, Philistines. Be men, or you will be subject to the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Be men and fight. So the Philistines fought, and the Israelites were defeated, and every man fled to his tent. The slaughter was very great. Israel lost 30,000 foot soldiers. The Ark of God was captured, and Eli's two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, died. So what was the big mistake? Well, it's more fundamental than mistaken archaeology. Yes, they were misusing the Ark, doing something with it that they should not have done. But it's a little more deeper than simply breaking the rules. They thought that they could manipulate God into fighting on their side. They thought, in a sense, that they actually had God in a box to be used by them. It was sort of rabbit's foot theology, lucky charm. The ark had become a talisman. God had become for them the genie of the lamp. If we drag that box onto the battlefield, God will be compelled to give us victory. After all, if he didn't, then he would be embarrassed, wouldn't he? It would look like he had lost against the Philistines, and that would never be. They're twisting his arm, aren't they? It's rather like those tricks you used to manipulate your parents when you're a teenager. You know, unless you pay for driving lessons, I'm getting a motorbike. Or, unless you take me to the party, I'll get a taxi, and then I might stay all night. And you never know what happens then, do you, Mum? We may be manipulated as parents. The stern fact is that God would rather allow 30,000 Israelite soldiers to be killed and the ark captured than he would jump and bark like their tame poodle. God will not be manipulated or controlled. He won't be summoned up to do our bidding. Your wish is my command. Now, we don't have an ark today, do we? But is there still a danger for us in this? Well, I'm sure there is. The Christian church has regularly fallen into the trap of trying to manipulate God's responses. And this can, from time to time, lead to downright scurrilous things. downright wrong in order to get an effect. Pagan tricks. Think, for example, of medieval relics that could get the peasants to give more money to the church. Think perhaps for some of the manipulative techniques that could be used in 19th century revivalism. If you get people to, you know, sit in a certain place and so on, or sing a certain way, then you get results. We may see it today too. You may have seen, for example, certain health and wealth teachers who can essentially use hypnotic techniques in order to get people to fall over. And there's evangelical pastors today who will admit and repent of having done that in the past. But what we're talking about here goes much deeper than that. We can't just say, oh, it's all them out there. We're talking about something far closer at home. Because the real issue, it seems to me, is that anything can be used as a means to try to put God in a box and manipulate him. Even things which are perfectly good and right and true. We believe, for example, in preaching the gospel, don't we? In sound theology and in upholding clear moral teaching and so on. And quite right too, I mean, that's my life vocation. So I believe in that. But the problem comes if we start to think that because we preach and uphold a certain theology and a moral stance, maybe in contrast to all those liberals who go wrong, well, then God is somehow obliged thereby to stand by us and defend his honour with us, regardless of anything else. And that doesn't necessarily follow, does it? Haven't you noticed that lots of the churches which preach the gospel and uphold a clear theology and a morality have closed nonetheless? And if they ever thought that merely by being sound in their teaching, God was obliged to bless them, well, frankly, they deserved to close, didn't they? Any more than thinking that if you've got Rooney on the pitch, you're sure to win the match. There is no talisman for success. And if we turn anything into a talisman, however good it might be, God will turn it into a liability. Likewise, the same mistake could be made in other areas too. Prayer, for example. Prayer, I mean, what church can be without prayer? But it can become a means to try and manipulate God. If we have lots of meetings for our harvest outreach, God is sure to bless us. If we fast for days and days and days and totally commit ourselves, he's bound to make it a fruitful time. Well, no, he isn't, actually. And the more we think like that, the less likely it becomes that he will. Any more than my guarantee for having a good sermon to lay before you on a Sunday is that I pray a lot in the week. Of course, I aim to pray a lot in the week, but it's not a guarantee that you'll hear a good sermon. And I can tell you that by experience, because I'll tell you the sermons where I prayed a lot and it wasn't so good. The point is, we can't box God. Not even with the best box we've got. The ark was the best box they had in Israel. But God would not meekly sit in it and be dragged out into the battlefield. I think this also sets the various debates that happen in the church over the years and happen now in a certain context too. You know, a contemporary style versus a classic style of music. The gifts of the Spirit versus less ostentatious gifts of the Spirit. The ministry of women or not the ministry of women, whatever they are. Which of those will God ultimately bless? The answer is none of them. None of them. Not if we think that simply by adopting this or that, we find a surefire means to get him on side with us. God will not be manipulated by the true means of grace any more readily than the false ones. Now, I admit this is a subtle distinction. Because, of course, we do want to preach and pray and get our worship and our ministry right and do all those things, of course. Indeed, we must. But there's nothing we can do to get God on side. And I take you right back to the point which we made at the start in this series, which was really looking down to this time here. It's not about how we get God on our side. It's about ensuring that we are on his side. And that means no rabbit's feet, no talisman, no God in a box, even the best and most respectable box we can imagine. It means true repentance from sin and true faith in God. It must start there, mustn't it? It means trusting in him and not trusting in our own solutions. Even though we know down the line we've got to do things and we've got to do the right things. We don't trust in them. We start with God himself. It means being willing to accept his agenda, including apparent defeat, if that's what it takes. If that's what he sees as being victory for his church in the long run. It means being willing to lose in order to win, if that's what he wants. I'll give you an example. I was a fairly public Christian as a student, known to be one of the people who organised the CU, if that's the right word. I don't know if organised was the right word as me as a student, but something happened anyway. And I can assure you that my public Christianity and confidence was really less to do with courage and huge faith and more to do with the absence of any social credibility on my part anyway. I had nothing to lose. So I'd often find myself debating and arguing with people about matters of faith. And I realise now, although I was probably too arrogant to realise it then, but I realise now that I lost the argument in probably the majority of cases. I suspect an objective listener listening in would have thought, nope, the atheist won. I lost to Mandy the feminist in my first week, really badly. I lost to Richard the liberal theologian. I lost to Judith the astrophysicist, really embarrassingly. I lost to Sebastian the revolutionary socialist. I regularly lost to Martin the Catholic at theology and table tennis too. I was soundly beaten on numerous occasions because it doesn't matter how good or true what you're arguing is. If you pick arguments with clever, articulate people, that's what happens. Sometimes you lose. And yet, in spite of losing so often, we still saw in the CU some half a dozen of our friends coming to faith. Not Mandy or Richard or Sebastian or any of those people who I lost to, but others who listened in. And not normally through me either, because I was too embarrassing to talk to about such things, but through my quiet friends who followed along behind me and cleaned up the damage afterwards. And who were given, I hope, a little more confidence in their faith with their friends. So I can look back on that time now and see that even though I lost lots of arguments, it was actually, in God's terms, quite a victorious time in the growth of the gospel. And in fact, I reckon now that if I'd won those debates, hands down, it probably could have been the worst thing I could have done. Because God used the fact that I was losing badly in public. Now, these days, I can't remember the last time I lost an argument with an unbeliever. I may have been with my granddad a few years ago. I can't remember the last time I've lost an argument with an unbeliever. And I'm not proud of that. Because I don't have debates with unbelievers anymore, do I? Is that so clever? Never lose or never talk about the gospel at all. I wonder why. I mean, perhaps it's just, you know, you grow up a bit and student life has lots of opportunities. Perhaps it's because people are afraid to have an argument with me because they think I will win, you know. Perhaps it's, though, it's because I'm too afraid to lose. Perhaps it's because I'm too concerned now to present as a credible, convincing winner. You know, I'm the pastor. I can't lose an argument, can I? You need to see me win them, don't you? Does God need to see me win arguments? I don't think so. But perhaps I've made the mistake of thinking the way to get God on my side is to have everything all wrapped up and neatly in a box so that I can give a good answer to any question that comes my way. The result, I fear, is that I'm personally more defeated now than I ever was then. And I have to ask, is the Lord calling me to repent of human confidence and replace it with divine confidence? True victory can only come if we repent from confidence in ourselves and our solutions altogether and turn to true confidence in God. Or else what? Disaster? Yes. Well, this was a true disaster, wasn't it? For Israel, it was a real, authentic disaster. The Ark of God captured by the Philistines? Can you imagine anything more disgraceful? Well, might Phinehas' daughter name her son Ichabod? The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured, she said. Except, of course, she got it the wrong way round, really. The Ark was captured because the glory of God had already gone. By then it was just a box with a few old things in it. And yes, true disaster and defeat can come and does strike God's church today. Think, for example, of Paul saying, you know, was it Hymenaeus and Alexander did harm to me? Yes, the gospel and the church can be harmed now. The church may have triumphed through apparent defeat in China, but what about what happened in North Africa? Once a Christian civilization, now the church there is a tiny rump of what it was before, and Islam dominates. The ultimate spiritual victory of Christ is assured, but it doesn't prevent the immediate spiritual defeat of his church from time to time. We need to know that what happened in North Africa in the 7th, 8th, 9th centuries could very readily happen in Western Europe and in the UK today, and much quicker than we'd ever thought. What will God do then? Well, fortunately, he is not in a box. He's in the battle, though. And even if he fought for the Philistines for a while, he was still on Israel's side, wasn't he? He fought for the Philistines on Israel's side. Stern as it may seem, the death of Hophni and Phinehas and even poor old 98-year-old Eli was for the good of his wider people. As the prophet's words had said, the dead wood of that family tree had to be cleared away. The boil had to be lanced. And now, because God fought for a while for the Philistines, a fresh expression of grace, a new start for Israel, a new generation of leader was possible, and Samuel's word came to all Israel. And in the meantime, with the ark captured and taken back as a trophy of war to Ashdod, well, we shall find that although Israel was defeated, God is not beaten yet. It may look like he is on the ropes, but actually, he can look after himself perfectly well. And next week, those Philistines will find out.